As Rex mentioned already, we're going to be in 1 Peter 3, beginning in verse 1. And again, if you don't have a Bible with you, we do have some available here for you. 1 Peter 3, beginning of verse 1. Because Rex read that for a moment for us a moment ago, I'll leave that to the side here. We're continuing our series in 1 Peter. And as we are, we come to a passage that is pretty interesting, right? We come to a passage that that is very well known and often misunderstood. And, you know, when I was searching through sermons on the passage, I was surprised to find that not very many treat verses 1 through 7 together. A lot of times it's 1 through 6 and then verse 7, or it's multiple sermons on 1 through 6 and then verse 7. And I can see how that might give the ability to focus on first the wife and then focus on second the husband. However, I thought it'd be more efficient to defend everyone at once. So also Rex asked me to preach 1 through 7. There you go. So, you know, marriage is a hot topic. It's an issue that is much discussed in our culture and in the church. And part of the reason for that is because of how bad we are at it, right? I mean, we see all kinds of examples around the world. Many just have just given up, right? They've rejected the idea altogether. Chosen cohabitation, thinking that that will spare them the troubles of divorce or separation. Interestingly, those who choose to live together before being married have higher rates of divorce and separation. Turns out God is up to something. You know, that's just one of the issues, right? I mean, we've got what the world calls open marriage. We've got what the world now calls same-sex marriage. We've got all kinds of distortions. I mean, we even have today people that can't define what a woman is or what a man is. And we have men pretending to be women, taking advantage of women. The roles of man and woman have been distorted since the beginning, right? We know that, right? We can look to Genesis 1 and 2 when God created male and female. They became one flesh. They were to live together in unity. And sin entered the world. Even in their sin, before sin entered the world, we see some dynamics there that don't reflect what God intends for marriage. And what do we find out in Genesis 3:16? As part of that curse, it says that a woman's desire will be for her husband, but her husband will rule over her. Both of those things are a distortion of God's design for marriage. They are a part of the curse of sin. And all those issues that we talk about in our culture and that very thing we see in Genesis 3, in each and every case, God's way has been rejected. God's word has been abandoned. Self-interest has been given priority, and we've placed ourselves on the throne. We, as sinners, have brought this evil. We're products of our culture, and we carry some of those things into our own way of life as Christians even. So how do we deal with this? How do we correct that? How do we develop a right view? How do we work towards recovering what has been lost? I think just like anything else, we need to no longer be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of our minds through the understanding of God's will as revealed in his word. That is our calling. We come to Christ, who is the cornerstone. We look to him, chosen and precious in the sight of God. As we, as living stones, are being built up into a household for God. We come as a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that we may proclaim the excellencies of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. That's what this is all about. When we come to this passage here in 1 Peter, the reason we misunderstand is because we separate it from the context. A lot of times that's part of it. Now, there are other issues as well, but that's a big part of why we misunderstand this passage. So how do we go about approaching that? Well, Rex read for us a larger portion there, beginning in chapter 2, verse 11. did not even finish, because we could continue that context on through the end of chapter 4, even suffering as a Christian. There's a few words that are very important there. Righteousness is one. Glory is another. Think about the glory of God. This idea in God's sight. We come to Christ, the cornerstone, chosen and precious in the sight of God. It's a gracious thing in the sight of God when you endure suffering. It is beautiful in the sight of God. We're going to talk about these characteristics of a woman. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. And all of this is in the context of suffering. Being Christians, having a living hope in a dying world. That's the context of this here. So we can't ignore that as we walk through these roles for husband and wife. We have to keep that in mind, that we're to live in such a way that points the world to Jesus. That is the focus here this morning, that husbands and wives are to live in such a way that points the world to Jesus. As we think about that main idea, we're going to see it first given to wives, and it is a call to live in such a way that is rooted in hope and points to Jesus. Second, we're going to see the call to husbands, and they're called to a way of living that is rooted in grace and points to Jesus. It's all about pointing to Jesus. You know, marriage is like a dance. And in most styles of dancing, there's a leader, there's someone who's leading, there's someone who's following. But you can't always see that when you're observing the dance. Why? Because their skills are working together to create a beautiful display. And oftentimes, the one who leads is leading in such a way that highlights the beauty and the strength of the one following. Marriage is like that dance. And so as we read through this passage, keep that in mind, that we, husbands and wives, are called to live in such a way with each other that points the world to Jesus. And for those here that are not married, maybe you look to that one day. Keep this in mind as a way to prepare your own heart for that prospect. Kids, as you hear this message, you're going to hear things about what a godly woman looks like, what a godly husband looks like, how they live. Keep those things in mind. Christian men and women, maybe you're single for the rest of your life. Maybe that's what God has called you to. Look to these qualities, admire them, and praise them, because they point to Jesus. We need to point out these things when we see them. So as we think about this idea, we're to live in such a way that points the world to Jesus. We're first going to look to wives. Wives are to live in a way that is rooted in hope and points to Jesus. The very first word of this passage is very important. He begins saying, likewise. That is such an important word here, because it shows us that he's continuing an idea. Likewise, wives. Well, what is he connecting with here? He's connecting with 2:18 in relation of servants to masters, and how their living in submission to their masters is to be in such a way that points the world to Jesus. It connects back to 2:13, where we're called to be subject to every human institution. Why? So that the world may see our good deeds and glorify God. It's all about pointing to Jesus, following Jesus. Of course, as we come to this passage, we have to ask the question, what does it mean to be subject? What does it mean for the wife to be subject? And how does this submission point to Jesus? Peter gives a command here, but it's more than a command. He paints for us a picture of biblical womanhood, a kind of living that points the world to Jesus. Women who are placing all their hope in God. And these women will exemplify this hope through the adorning of the gospel in a way that proclaims the truth about Jesus. The first thing we see in this role is that this way of living is one of submission, with the goal of pointing to Jesus. Now, I'm going to continue saying that, and it might get a little redundant for me to say pointing to Jesus, but this is the focus here. Wives are called to this way of living is one of submission, with the goal of pointing to Jesus. What it means for a wife to be subject to her own husband, is something that, that's widely debated, right? We know that. We know that coming in here. It might be even debated amongst the homes that are represented here. You can laugh. That's okay. Maybe nervous to laugh. You think, what are they thinking of me? Case in point here, right? We have issues with this. We struggle with this. We don't know exactly how to live this out because we've been more shaped by our culture. Some call this kind of submission controlling, chauvinistic, misogynistic. Others just brush it off and say, that was then. This is now. We're in a different world. We won't be able to solve all of our problems and iron out all of those wrinkles here today. But by God's grace, as we walk through this, we will see that this kind of submission, this what this calling is for women, is intended to point to Jesus. It is a beautiful thing. It is a wonderful thing. It is not a blank check for the husband to control the wife. It is interesting. There is one detail here that often gets glanced over. Wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. Think about the wives in this context and what they would be dealing with, what they would be living in. It was expected in this culture, if not required in this culture, that a wife would follow the religion of her husband. And so when a wife in this culture comes to Jesus, just think about the tension. Just think about what's being said of her. It might be said of her, you're not being submissive. You're supposed to follow me into this. But these wives are called to live in those situations, suffering while doing good for the glory of God. It doesn't mean that there would be a doormat. It doesn't mean that you give in to every desire, every wish. It doesn't mean that you give up thinking. It doesn't mean that you do not possess more strong qualities than your husband. And we see all of these things in this passage here, because we're talking about a believing woman who has a pagan husband. She's obviously the one in the right, like every other argument in marriage, right? She's obviously the one in the right. But how is she to win? How is she to win and prove that she's right? It's not through argument. He says, so that if even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of the wives. It doesn't mean you don't say a word. It just means that the way that this man is to be won to Christ is by a life that points to Christ. That's the weight of the argument. That's the key to unlocking this problem. Live in such a way that points to Jesus. And by so doing, you are pointing your husband to Christ. And the same goes for women in marriage with a believing husband. You live in such a way that points to Jesus. Think about that passage again to the servants a little while back. And he says to live in such a way that your good deeds will silence the talk of foolish people, right? Maybe we can silence the talk of foolish people through our good deeds, right? That's what he's saying there. It's the same thing happening in this marriage. The husband is ridiculing this woman for following Christ, not following after his gods. And she's proving that Christ is better. She's proving that following Jesus is better. Suffering while doing good and emulating Christ Jesus. So even as those wives are called in that difficult position, they're called to exercise submission in a way that points to Jesus. Ladies here today that are married, that is what this submission is intended to do. Is it intended to point your husbands to Christ and to the gospel, to remind them of who Jesus is. The qualities that are here given describing this woman are qualities we would use describing Jesus. Gentle, respectful, pure. These are things that we would attribute to Jesus, and the women here are being called to follow and emulate Jesus. The purpose of this submission is for the sake of the gospel. I mentioned a few things a moment ago. I want to list a few things here as well on what this submission does not mean. so that we'll better understand what it does mean. And a few of these have been said already. It's not blind submission, right? Doesn't mean giving up independent thought. And that's clearly illustrated here by a wife who is going in a different direction than her husband. She's following Jesus. She's not following his religion. You know, when a husband, you read these stories of these bad marriages where the husband thinks that the wife needs to ask his permission to do something. Is that what we're talking about here? Is that what we see here? I don't believe so. You say, well, so it's not blind. It's not passive. It cannot mean giving up efforts to influence your husband, because she's clearly told, here's how you influence your husband. Here's how you influence your husband. Not manipulate, right? He's not talking about giving them a way of manipulating their husband to get what they want. That would be following after the ways of the world, wouldn't it? But he's giving them a way that they might influence their husbands. How is that? It is by their conduct. In the case of an unbelieving husband, that's obvious. But it even remains possible when a man and wife who are both believers living together, that the wife may need to live in such a way that influences her husband towards the gospel. I don't know about you men here, but I don't always do the best job of leading my wife and my family. Sometimes I'm in need of my wife pointing that out to me. And her pointing that out in me is not a lack of submission. It is a loving way of submitting first to Christ and then seeking to influence her husband and pointing him to Jesus. The submission is not absolute. It doesn't mean giving in to every demand. And just like in the case of the servant here, there'll be times when the husband asks something that's not good. And there'll be times when you do things as a wife that your husband won't see as good, and yet you're seeking to follow Jesus. Might be considered evil by the unbelieving husband, or even by your believing husband might consider something that you're doing wrong. But your greater authority is to God. That is your greater authority. And so you follow God. It's not timid. The submission is not timid. It doesn't mean living in fear of your husband or being afraid to speak a word. We'll see more on that here in a moment as we go through. Peter's going to give us a few examples of holy women, and he's going to give us specifically of Sarah. So we're going to look at that more in a moment. What does this submission mean? If it doesn't mean those things, what does it mean? It means following the example of Jesus. It means acknowledging and honoring God's design for marriage. That God has given the husband this role to lead. Just as Jesus submitted to his Father in all things that were commanded of him, submitting to God's design, we too, husband and wife, submit to God's design for marriage. We see that in Ephesians 5 more clearly in these roles and how they complement each other. And it is a way of living in which we are submitting to one another as well. It is the strength of gentleness. That is what this kind of submission is. It's the strength of gentleness. It means gentleness and respect that affirms the role of the husband. And notice that nowhere in there does it say, if your husband is worthy, right? Because none of us here are, right? It doesn't say that. Why respect a man who's not respectable? Well, because this is God's design. You don't have to respect everything about him, but you're called to a life of respect. And this is not exclusive. This is not exclusive to the wife. We're going to see that in a minute as well. This kind of submission is rooted in hope, and it means entrusting yourself to God, placing your hope in God alone. We should notice here that Peter doesn't go into all the details of what that submission looks like in the home, right? He doesn't give this detailed list of how wives are meant to wash the dishes and cook dinner, how husbands are to cut the grass and take out the garbage. He doesn't go into all those details. We'd say that's wisdom, right? That's wisdom. It doesn't go into all those details. But it truly is wisdom. Why? Because these things are going to look different from culture to culture. From time to time, they're going to look different. The things that you do within your marriage are going to look different from culture to culture, and there is no one absolute standard of what that looks like. Remember, it's a dance. It's a dance. You got to decide how that's working out for you. And you've got to work that together. We're going to get to in a moment how husbands are to lead in that and how they are to take up the role to lead. But we remember that this is a dance. So that we saw that this way of living is one of submission that points to Christ. Another thing we see here in this call to wives is that this way of living is one of placing priority on inward beauty. Look at verses 3 and 4 with me. Says, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is in God's sight very precious. Here we go again, that idea of being in God's sight very precious. It's a righteous way of living that is more concerned with what God sees than what the world sees. It is a focus and a placing of priority on inward beauty, a life of emulating Jesus. He says, don't let your adorning be external. That's stated pretty plainly, right? And gives examples, braiding of hair and jewelry and all this. But does that mean that the women aren't to adorn themselves externally? Does it mean that they can't or that they shouldn't? Not at all. What it means is that that should not be their focus. That should not be their priority. On the other end of that, it doesn't mean let yourself go, right? It doesn't mean that either. But it means placing priority on what God places priority on. Man looks on outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. It matters little what the world says of beauty. Not to mention that beauty is fading. I mean, I know you ladies in here, that doesn't happen for you, but in the world, it does. The beauty fades. No, this beauty is fading. This beauty is fading. It's perishable. It's fleeting. So if we are preoccupied with those things, what is that saying of your confidence? What's that saying of your value? If you're placing your value in things that wash off, things that the moth eats, if you're placing your value in those things, what is it saying of your confidence? And as a side note here, husbands, we need to be careful about this as well. What are we communicating to our wife about beauty? How are we pointing out the beautiful qualities in them that have to do with the inward person? I mean, it's one thing to comment your wife on, oh, that's a nice dress, or you look pretty today. When's the last time you pointed out one of these godly characteristics in your wife? I say that with conviction because I do not do this well either. But it is a point of application here. If this is what God values, this is what you ought to value. This kind of living is one that puts priority on inward beauty. So what makes you beautiful? It's the braiding of hair. It's not the gold jewelry. Another interesting thing here when we think about this passage is, you know, most of these women couldn't afford the gold jewelry in this culture, right? That was the wealthy women who did these braids up in like a high shape, rolled up on their head and put gold over top of it. We're talking about the real housewives of Pontus and Galatia is what we're talking about, okay? But the point remains the same. For those, even if you don't have the gold and the jewelry and, you know, the hairstylist that can do the cool braids, if you don't have all of those things, it still matters where you're placing your priority. And this way of living places priority on inward beauty. Don't get caught up in what the world says is beautiful. Don't measure your beauty, ladies, by likes and follows on social media. Beauty is vain. And deceitfulness, riches will fail us. You know, we can look here to the example of the Proverbs 31 woman. What does it say of her? It says she dresses herself with strength. Strength and dignity are her clothing. It says, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but the woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Are we praising these qualities? And it concludes that by saying, give her the fruit of her hands. Give her what she deserves. Give her what she has earned, and let her works praise her in the gates. This is a life worth emulating. We were reminded Friday at the service for Rex's mom, how she in many ways exemplified that woman. And again, to point out the things that this is not, from what I understand, she was not a timid woman. She was not a weak woman. She was strong and courageous, fearless, even from what I understand. This is the kind of life you're to imitate and emulate. And we see that as he moves forward, he says, this way of living is one of hope. Hope in God and doing good without fear. This is the third aspect here in these first six verses. It's one of submission that points to Jesus for the purpose of pointing to Jesus. It's one of placing priority on inward beauty. And here it is one of hope in God and doing good without fear. Peter commends them to the holy women of God. He says, this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. He mentions holy women, but the only one he mentions by name is Sarah. Sarah is an interesting character, isn't she? When you read through the story of Genesis, she also was not a weak woman, was she? She does not seem to be a pushover. We can see two places in Scripture where we find her being fearless. And it's almost kind of just, you just walk right past it. In Genesis 12 and in Genesis 20, Abraham is the one that's afraid. And what does he say? Hey, don't tell them you're my wife. Otherwise, they're going to kill me. And what does she do? She went along with it. She put herself in harm's way to protect her husband. Now, what does that say of Abraham? Well, but it points to her strength. Her willingness to suffer points to Jesus. Her willingness to suffer for her husband emulates Jesus. Then we got this issue here of her calling him Lord. What's that all about? Are you ladies supposed to call your husband Lord? Jerry, I've got a few words for you in a moment. Just hold on. Verse 6 is coming. You got me off track there, man. You can't do that. You can't do that. No, there's one passage in the Old Testament, only one reference with Sarah calling him Lord. It's in Genesis 18:12. Only one. This is the only time. It's pretty interesting, actually, because she never says it aloud. It's her laughing in her heart, it says. She laughed to herself. Ha. When I'm worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? Talking about the promise for them to have a child. That goes to show us that this is not some kind of prescription that you need to, you know, speak to your husband with titles, right? I mean, that should be stated, right? But it also just shows this is a general term of respect. My Lord, right? You think about Old English, my Lord. Didn't mean that someone was better than you. It just meant that they had different status. They were leading. Taking those examples of Sarah, we see that she had placed her hope in God. Her hope was not in Abraham. That's also made clear. She didn't even have hope that Abraham could do his part in fulfilling the promise. Right? Or in seeing God's promise fulfilled. And then or at least she didn't think she could fulfill her part. But her hope was in God. She's imperfect, sure. Her hope was in God. She didn't fear anything that was frightful. That's what he calls you to here. He says, you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightful. Think back to the Proverbs 31 woman. She clothes herself with dignity and laughs at the days to come. Why? Because our hope is in God. It's not one of fearing your husband. If your hope is in God, you have no reason to fear. Even if you're in a bad relationship, you have no reason to fear. Clothe yourself in strength and dignity, which is hope and fear of the Lord. This is the kind of submission and the way of living that points to Jesus. So far, we've considered that way of living as it relates to wives, and I've not given you all the details of what that looks like in your home, just like Peter didn't. But now we move on to husbands and how they're to live in a way that is rooted in grace and which points to Christ. I failed to mention earlier, you know, we look at this passage and we see, you know, we got six verses for the wife and one for the husband. Why is that? Well, remember the context here for a moment, right? This is talking about suffering while doing good. And in this context, the wife in the culture was in a position where she was more likely to be taken advantage of. We're going to see a little bit more about that as well. He says she's the weaker vessel. She's able to be taken advantage of. Just like he refers to the slave and not the master. Why? Because he's pointing to those who are in positions that are kind of most set up to emulate Christ through suffering while doing good. And husbands, as we read this, this might only be one verse, but our verse comes with a warning. Notice that. Our verse comes with a warning. There's a consequence to rejecting this way of living. And that consequence we're going to hear in a moment is that our prayers will be hindered. Think about this for a moment. The way of living the wife is called to is called precious in God's sight, right? Jesus in chapter 2 in the beginning was called precious in God's sight. Suffering while doing good is called gracious in God's sight. When we look at those last verses that Rex read, it says, the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. These are righteous qualities. This is a righteous way of living. Notice also what he says there. His ears are open to their prayer. His ears are open to the prayer of the righteous. When we take that, connect it back here with so that your prayers may not be hindered, the idea is that if you're not living this way, husbands, this is not precious in God's sight. God's ear is not open to your prayer. If you will not submit to what God is calling you to, there is a warning. So husbands, we're to live in a way that is rooted in grace and points to Christ. It also begins with the word likewise. If we think about that larger context of being subject to every human institution, there is a way in which we husbands are being called to submit to a design. We're called to submit to what God has designed for this institution of marriage. We're called to submit to what God calls us to. And if we're not submitting to that, we are rejecting God and our prayers will be hindered. Notice what he doesn't say here. He doesn't say exercise authority over your wives. He doesn't even say lead your wives. What does he say? He says, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. Live with your wives in an understanding way. Well, what does that even mean? Live with your wives in an understanding way. If you like, every other man on the planet Earth, you have trouble understanding your wife, right? Ladies, you won't say the feeling is mutual because you've got us all figured out, right? There's facts. There's a reason that this command is given to the husband. We can be pretty thick-headed. Men, we can think we know it all, and we can easily abuse this role that God's given us, okay? So the wife is in a position that is more likely to face suffering. The husband is in a position to take advantage of something here and further that. This verse is mitigating a husband causing the wife suffering. That's not the only thing it's doing, right? It's about living in a way that points to Jesus. But living in a way that points to Jesus is a way of living that is one of understanding first. It's one of understanding. The word here literally means according to knowledge. Knowledge of what? Some think it's referring to knowing the role that God has given. Others think that it means to knowing your wife. I think both apply. I think we need to know the role that God has given us. And we need to treat our wives according to this knowledge that God has given us through his word, living according to his will. But I also think we need to know our wives. I think we need to understand. We need to seek to understand. What this living with understanding does not mean, just to highlight a few things here. Like one of the qualifiers of submission, it is not passive. This way of living with understanding is not passive. It doesn't mean deferring in all things, at all times. It doesn't mean letting go of your role as a husband, as a man to lead. You know, Peter, again, never gets into the details of what submission looks like in each marriage. And I think one of the fruits of living with understanding is being willing to defer on many things. The willingness to defer is a way of living with understanding. It's a way of showing honor, we're going to see here in a moment. But as you stand before God, you're accountable. You're accountable to lead your family, to disciple your children. Your wife is probably smarter than you, and that's okay. And if she's more equipped to disciple your children, then you need to encourage that. You need to foster that. There's nothing wrong with having a wife that is smarter than you. That's a wonderful thing. You guys are really quiet right now. I don't hear any amens. Just being quiet, trying to live with understanding. This way of living with understanding, it's not passive. But it's also not overly concerned. It's not overly concerned with superficial matters, right? Not overly concerned, kind of like the placing priority on inward beauty. It's not overly concerned with superficial matters. You know, you've heard the phrase in our culture, in our time, about getting in touch with your feminine side. You know that? And I heard something to go like this. I am in touch with my feminine side. Her name's Carolina. She's gone. She left. Okay. We're out of touch at the moment, but there you go. But this living with understanding requires us to think about things. You know, we need to think about how God has made us, how God has shaped us, how God has created us. It's not overly concerned with being nice. Sometimes we have to do difficult things in a marriage. This goes both ways, right? Sometimes we have to say difficult things. That doesn't mean you're not understanding me. You guys remember that video when the lady who has a nail in her head? She's like, I just have this pressure. It's a constant and it's there. And he's like, well, you got a nail in your head. And she's like, it's not about the nail. You remember that video? I ran across that video. I was like, yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, this is not what living with understanding means. It doesn't mean ignoring certain things that are there. And just saying, yes, dear. Now, at the same time, just to caution you against the other direction here, it does mean listening. It does mean listening. Living with understanding means listening. We are called, husbands, to study our wives. To study our wives, to know their likes, dislikes, to know their wants, needs, desires, to know those things. And we think about how God cares for us. We think about how God loves us. How God doesn't give us only what we need, but he goes above and beyond to show his grace to us. Husbands, in your relationship to your wife, think about that. You're called to live in such a way that is rooted in grace and points to Jesus. Be gracious in seeking to understand your wife. Be honest when you don't understand. And in so doing, you point to Jesus. So what part of this does mean is it means considering the needs of your wife. It means considering her needs as more significant than your own. That would have been countercultural just as much as mentioning the wife first or the slave first. Telling the men that they are to live in an understanding way, showing honor to their wives, that would have been controversial in that culture. It's controversial in ours sometimes as well, in little pockets where we think that that we know how we are to live and we've got it all figured out, and I don't need to understand someone else's point of view in order to lead well. But we do, husbands. We need to understand the needs of our wife. We need to understand the frame. And if you're not sure, there's a quote that comes to mind for me, and I know some of you will know this, that whenever I'm about to do something, I think, would an idiot do that? And if they would, I do not do that thing. Now, those of you who know the quote, you know where it comes from. The reason that is so funny is because we're often the source of the material for that idiot, right? We as men, we're often learning by mistakes, right? I'm not trying to beat you over the head or anything like that. I'm here too. But we can be idiots sometimes. We need to seek to live with understanding, showing honor to our wives, living and acting in such a way that points them to Jesus. That's what this is all about. We see this way of living as one of understanding. And second, we see that it is a way of living is one of honor for your wife as the weaker, yet co-heirs in the grace of life. We're commanded to understand our role. And we need not to be thinking like the world in our relationships, but we're called to look to Jesus in how we love. We're called to live like Jesus, to provide, to protect. And that command is strengthened here, pointing to this co-equal status that we have as co-heirs. We have a co-equal status. Brothers, you're not any higher than your wife or any closer to God than your wife merely by the fact that you're a man. You're co-heirs. You're one flesh together. This is a dance. We're called to show honor considering the frame, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. Does it mean that they are weak in character? Does it mean they're weak in intellect? It's a simple statement of the fact that when we look at men and women, men are generally stronger. For instance, if you put a man in a race swimming against women, the man's going to win. For instance. You're following. Just lately. Showing honor to your wife as the weaker vessel is not carried out here, and hear this, by reminding them of the differences between your roles. I've heard it said, and I've actually read something along these lines. I'll give you a little picture, an illustration of what it's like. It goes something like this. Sure, submission is hard, but I'm called before God to carry the load and the greater weight of responsibility. That's much harder. And you're fortunate that you don't have my role. You ever heard anything like that? That's not showing honor. That's dishonor. It's a failure to understand. It's a failure to understand this role that we've been called into. And just to plug in and answer your question, that's something an idiot would say, right? Answer that question from a moment ago. We're called to show honor to our wives, considering their frame, but also considering their status as co-heirs. Friends, we are equals as we stand before God. We have no claim to hold over the wife. Do we really need to be reminded again that some of our wives are smarter than us anyway? They're better than us in a lot of things. Do we need to be reminded of that? But we are co-equals. We need to embrace that. We need to celebrate that. Don't forget, it was in the beginning that God said it was not good for man to be alone. And that it wasn't until he created the woman that he said it is very good. I want you to think about something for a moment. And it is this. Man alone does not fully image the glory of God. It was in the creation of male and female that God created man in his image. We each have ways that we reflect God's character. We each have ways that we point to who he is. We each have strengths and weaknesses related to our frame, related to how God has made us. Men, honor your wives as they are co-heirs with you in this grace. We might be the stronger vessel, but we are vessels nonetheless. We need to remember that. If we're going to live in a way that's rooted in grace, we need to remember that. So there's a consequence here. This is the final thing. There's a consequence for rejecting the wisdom of God and living with understanding while showing honor. There's a consequence. It says, rejecting this way of living comes at a price. Rejecting this way of living comes at a price. If we're not living this way, husbands, it is as if we stop the ears of God. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. We've been given a standard of what that righteousness looks like in the home and in the marriage. And if we're not submitting to that, if we reject that, we cannot presume that we are good when we go before God. Our unrighteousness, our unwillingness to submit to God's design stops his ears for our prayers. Think about that. But the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ear is open to their prayer. Seek to live with your wives in such a way that points to Jesus. This is a righteous way of living. It is a way of understanding. It's a way of showing honor. And it comes with a price. Rejection of this way comes with a price. Friends, as we seek to point the world to Jesus, as husbands and wives, we're to live with each other in such a way that does just that. We're to live with each other in such a way that points to Jesus. Wives, living in such a way that is rooted in hope and points to Jesus. Husbands, living in such a way that is rooted in grace and points to Jesus. So that when they see our good deeds, they will glorify God. This is the purpose of it all. That is our prayer, that in our lives with one another, that God would be pleased, that it would be precious in God's sight. This is the life that we're called to. May God have his way in us, in our marriages, and may he be glorified in all that we say, think, and do. Let's pray.